Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month at noon on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streams at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. Hello, I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, host of the In Context War Report, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe, and our producer, Gus Canavero.
Hey, everybody.
Marshawn, let's begin with the Ukrainian crisis, which started in February with the U.S.-backed overthrow of Ukraine's pro-Russian government. The pro-Russian Luhansk Regional Council in eastern Ukraine recently stated, quote, "A civil war provoked by the Kiev authorities is raging in Ukraine." Is this a civil war in Ukraine?
Well, I would definitely think so. I mean, whether it is provoked by the outside or not is immaterial. If we were to look at two examples of civil war can be, on the one hand, the Irish Civil War is a great example. That is, the Irish people or a segment of the Irish population rebelling against the Irish government. Now, it was different than when they rebelled against the English occupation because that was one entity fighting another. But here you had two entities within the same country. It was a revolution, but also a civil war. On the other hand, a case of secessionism and civil war would be like the American Civil War. And I think that's what you're seeing in the Ukrainian example is not the Irish Civil War, but the American Civil War. You have one segment of the country saying, we don't want to go along with this anymore. We don't want to go along with the Kiev government. We're Russian speakers. We don't like the ultra-nationalist tone that the Ukrainian government's taking. We're going our own way. And whether or not they're backed by Russia really is immaterial because it is, for all intents and purposes, a civil war. It's a segment of the Ukrainian population deciding they don't want to be part of Ukraine anymore. And they're fighting for that right.
And in fact, they did have a vote at May the 11th, what they called a federalization referendum in the eastern part of the country. Of course, it was the vote wasn't recognized by the authorities in Kiev, but the voters in that part of the country overwhelmingly approved a referendum to federalize the country. And even in spite of the fact that Russia had requested that they postpone the vote, and immediately after the vote, the leader of the what they call the Donetsk Republic, the secessionist group in eastern Ukraine, pro-Russian secessionists, requested joining Russia. But Russia's playing kind of a cool game. They turned it down, and Putin claims that he wants a negotiated solution, a negotiated Ukraine federation. So he's kind of taking the high ground, appearing to be somewhat distant from the secessionists. But of course, they do represent an effort to stop Ukraine from going into NATO, which is really at the root of this crisis. Was several years ago, the leaders of NATO met and said they wanted to bring the Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, and that's really what this whole dispute about is about, and that's why the United States staged this coup d'état in which they overthrew the pro-Russian president of the Ukraine and installed a U.S.-backed person. Can we talk about some of the fighting that's actually going on the ground? You have this Odessa, this incident where 46 people were killed, and also there's fighting going on in Slavyansk, other cities including Kramatorsk. Can you talk about the fighting and the violence?
Absolutely. Well, what went on in Odessa was nothing short of a butchery. I watched the video of what happened in Odessa of the attack on the trade union center. Now, what had happened initially is you had groups of protesters, pro-Ukrainian, pro-Russian, and the pro-Russian protesters and the pro-Ukrainian protesters started lobbing rocks at each other. Who started doing it first doesn't matter. What matters is the fact that the pro-Russian protesters fled into the trade union building in Odessa. The building was then surrounded by pro-Kiev militants, right sector militants in black fatigues and balaclavas, and they were hurling Molotov cocktails into the building to set it on fire. Now, the U.S. media was reporting this as, oh, well, it was, you know, the building caught fire by accident. No, that's a complete fabrication. You can look at the video in any major news outlet, except an American one, and what you'll see is that these Kiev protesters, quote-unquote, are lobbing Molotov cocktails into the building. Then as people are climbing out of the windows, the video shows the people inside the building being pelted with rocks, Molotov cocktails, and bullets are getting shot at as they're trying to come out the windows. So they were intentionally forced in the building, and many of them, about 40 of them, were burned alive in the building. Now, this is absolute barbarism, but it's done one of two things. On the one hand, it was a move by the Kiev government to try to intimidate the pro-Russian elements. And, of course, it failed miserably. The U.S. tried to cover on the international scene, or domestically anyway, within the United States, for the Kiev militants, say, well, it was an accident. We don't know anything about it. Move on. But what it really did, though, was it galvanized support. Before the major vote, it galvanized support in places like Donetsk, in Lugansk, in Kramatorsk, in all these regions that decided they wanted to secede. It really gave, in the minds of ethnic Russians, the idea that these people want to butcher us. They want to ethnically cleanse Ukraine of ethnic Russians. This isn't Russian propaganda. Yulia Tymoshenko, the head of the Fatherland Party, said they need to, quote unquote, use nuclear weapons or whatever means possible to exterminate, or her words, incinerate the ethnic Russian population. So what you're seeing going on in Ukraine now is the radicalization of the ethnic Russians, because Odessa embodied that fear made manifest.
Marchand, can you tell us about the fighting that's going on in the eastern Ukraine city of Slavyansk?
Absolutely. Well, after what happened in Odessa, it certainly stirred the ethnic Russians on to sterner effort. I mean, anybody who was sitting on the fence before, certainly this must have left a strong impression on them. There is intense street fighting. The Ukrainian army cannot make it into the cities. Now, one thing that strikes me as very interesting when you look at this is it is reminiscent of the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia, the invasions of Chechnya, in so much as when we look at the urban fighting that the Russians went through when they went into Prague, when they went into Grozny in Chechnya, they were resisted by the entire population. And you're seeing that in Slavyansk, in Kramatorsk, in Lugansk, because every time the Ukrainian army tries to roll its armored vehicles through, they get pelted with Molotov cocktails, by just crowds. I mean, I've seen the videos, and you can look them up on YouTube. You'll see videos of just mobs swarming the tanks. And, you know, the crews take cover inside the tanks so they don't get hurt by the crowd. And then the tanks are set on fire. What we're seeing here now is a whole populace resisting, because if it was just some radical Russian militiamen, the Ukrainian army would have been able to roll in and knock these guys out. Russian militias have been able to shoot down several Ukrainian helicopters, most notably in Slavyansk. They shot down between 2 and 4, it's hard to be sure, but between 2 and 4 Ukrainian army helicopters. Now, these aren't guys with just shotguns pelting these things down. They must be using something pretty substantial to bring down these helicopters, so which suggests they probably are getting arms from Russia, very possibly surface-to-air missile systems, man-portable surface-to-air missile systems, which is something that the Ukrainians have been complaining about.
Do you think there are any Russian forces, say KGB, on the ground?
Absolutely. I mean, we have CIA in Kiev. The Russians would be fools not to have the FSB on the ground.
I'm sorry, it's the FSB now, right?
Absolutely, yes. they would be fools not to have the FSB or the GRU, which is Russian military intelligence, on the ground in eastern Ukraine. But the fact is that this resistance to the Ukrainian government would not work. It would not work if it was just a handful of militiamen.
Now, the Russians, Putin made a big show of withdrawing Russian troops from the Ukraine-Russian border. What is the point of that?
Well, Putin's done that a couple times. But the fact is that these troops are not pulling back very far from the border. They're going to their training bases, or they're leaving one set of training bases for another. These training bases are all along the Ukrainian border, so he's just moving the players around. You know, he's just moving pieces on a map a little bit, but he's not pulling back from the border. The only reason he's doing this is to, again, say, I'm not interfering. This is just the popular will of Ukraine, of ethnic Russians in Ukraine. Now, how much of it is being egged on by the FSB and the GRU, and how much of it is genuine, no one can say. But certainly, the Russians are trying to give a hands-off appearance.
An aspect that hasn't been discussed too much is that the Ukrainian manufacturing sector is very important to the Russian military-industrial complex, and that's another reason why Russia does not want to see Ukraine fall into NATO.
Well, exactly. And also, all of that manufacturing is mostly located in the east of Ukraine. So if east of Ukraine secedes, and as it's gotten a little bit of coverage in the U.S. press, but not very much, it was really in the BBC, the Eastern Ukrainian People's Republic of Donetsk and the Republic of Lugansk have petitioned to join Russia, and they're planning on holding a referendum sometime this fall on joining Russia, which, you know, would be huge, because then that means Russia would just sweep in militarily and annex that part of Ukraine. But it would be important for Russia because it'd be annexing what is the industrial heartland of the Ukraine and vital, as you mentioned, to the Russian military-industrial complex.
You know, it's really sad to see what's happening to the people just being used as pawns in this entire game. You know, Ukraine is a very valuable region. It's a large country, and it has great capabilities. And I spoke to a woman just 2 days ago who is from Ukraine, and she still has family in the west of Ukraine. And I asked her just what her feelings are and what's happening, and she's just, they're scared. When she's in communication with her family, you know, they're not in any danger because they're in the western side of Ukraine. But the part that kind of got me was that she didn't even have any opinion on what side was in control of Ukraine. It was just that they are used to being used by outsiders and not being in control of their own destiny. So it was sort of a fait accompli that somebody is going to take control of Ukraine, and it won't be Ukrainians running the country for their own well-being and national interests.
And neither side is truly helping the situation because, as you mentioned before, on the one hand, you have these borderline neo-Nazis backed mm-hmm. by the, you know, NATO and the EU. And I say neo-Nazis because Svoboda and Right Sector are, for all intents and purposes, neo-Nazi organizations. I mean, they use the SS symbols and all that stuff. And then
you're not exaggerating. They really are neo-Nazis.
And we knew that they were going to be part of the government when we supported this coup.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and like I say, they use the swastika, they use the wolf angle. They say that their stated mission is the extermination of ethnic Russians. But then on the other hand, you have people like in the eastern provinces who say no, they want to restore the Soviet glory. That's why they call themselves the People's Republic of Donetsk, which scares people in the western part of Ukraine. So for Ukrainians, they're left with only two choices. And this is part of what Russia and the United States have created for the Ukrainians. Either you side with the radical neo-Nazis or you side with the Soviet communist system.
Yeah.
And what's happening is instead of stepping in and arbitrating and saying, you know, instead of getting, you know, the countries together to maybe have a peacekeeping mission to try to arbitrate, instead of doing that, what we're doing is we're pushing the Ukrainians to an offensive, which is only antagonizing and alienating those pro-Russian elements, any non-ethnic Russian element, because they're under siege.
And as we previously reported, the head of the CIA visited Kiev just before this offensive began. And there are reports now that about 400 elite mercenaries from Academy, which is formerly Blackwater, the mercenary company of America, are taking part in the Ukrainian military operation against these anti-government secessionists in the eastern part of the Ukraine. That report comes from a German newspaper, Bild am Sonntag, and it cites a German intelligence report which was submitted to Chancellor Merkel.
But the fact is that this is the same thing that went on in the Renaissance, in the heyday of mercenaries. One kingdom would hire mercenaries to go fight another. And it was exemplified by experiences throughout the Cold War, where we would hire mercenaries to go fight left-wing elements in other countries. The Contras are a great example. The only difference is that in the Ukraine, it's more open that we're using these mercenaries. Mm-hmm. But politics doesn't change. The fact that history doesn't change. The fact is that this is part of the playbook.
And NATO has other leverage going. We have the U.S. guaranteeing $1 billion in Ukrainian euro bonds at an interest rate of 2.9%. And someone commented, wouldn't it be nice if American students got a loan rate like that? And the International Monetary Fund is given the green light for a $17 billion Ukraine aid package.
We're in a new empire game.
Yes.
And instead of us selling our brand of government and then you can either buy it or not, which is what Russia does, we confuse people with subversion and we trick them into taking our game and our brand of empire, which is all these shell organizations like the IMF and NATO. And we confuse people so much through subterfuge and we sell them with a bait and switch. You know, these predatory loans that the IMF is going to do to get countries under the thumb for decades so that they can never break free.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Gus. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report, broadcast on WPKN 89.5 FM in Ridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. My name is Ken McDermott. I'm your host. I'm here with Gus Cadavero, our producer, and we're talking with Marshawn McDermott Rowe, In Context Military Affairs commentator. And we've been speaking about the crisis in Ukraine, and we're going to cover some of the other developments around the world. But folks, what we want you to understand is that there's more to the events than you're going to pick up from the network news. It's, as Gus said, it's really an empire game. And the American public really needs to understand what we're involved in, what our leaders' objectives are, and most importantly, what risks present to the American people, to our country. We should be aware of these risks. We should be thinking critically about whether the foreign policy this government pursues is the one that's really in the interest of the United States of America. I'm sorry, Marshawn, go ahead.
The fact is that the Russians actually are at – we accuse them of this, you know, 19th century past imperialism. The Russians, though, are at the forefront of modern imperialism in so much as old imperialism was conquest, the colonial imperialism. And it goes through cycles in human history. But if we look at the most recent, you have the colonial imperialism of the 19th century, occupy land, plant your flag, it's a colony. Then of the 20th century imperialism, which was ideological, the free world democracy, quote unquote, versus socialist workers' paradise, quote unquote. You know, that was how you colonized other countries, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. We have decided ever since the end of the Cold War, we don't need the ideology really of democracy. We don't really need to, especially you're seeing that with this current incarnation. We're interested more in manipulating these other countries through subterfuge. Well, the Russians have come up with a brilliant new form of imperialism, and they rally the world around anti-Americanism, which I find fascinating because
it's an easy sell in a lot of places.
And you know, Marshawn, really we had discussed this in a recent show about how the right-wing parties like the National Front in France are actually siding with the Russians, seeing Russia as an important counterweight against U.S. imperialism.
What's really striking about this new Russian form is that it's uniting on the one hand Marie Le Pen's party, the National Front in France, right-wing, pro-Russian. On the other hand, you have the East German the German Socialist Party now, the German Socialist Party, the German left-wing coalition singing Putin's praises. He is rallying people from the right and the left. He's bringing in Islamists from Iran. You know, you have support in an Islamic Republic like Iran, a right-wing neo-fascist state like Syria. The Baathism was born out of fascism. And then he has support from, he supports Hezbollah. So Putin is the most 21st century of all imperialists in that Putin says, I don't care what kind of government you have. I don't care if you have a Islamic government, if you have a communist government, if you have a socialist government, if you have a democratic government, if you have a fascist government, as long as you're anti-American. Mm-hmm. And there is sort of a policy of mutual benefit. The fact that Russia sort of has – it's like the old mobsters. You know, you scratch my back and I scratch yours. And Putin learned this from his days when he was working for the mayor of St. Petersburg, when after the fall of the Soviet Union, he made all these dirty deals with the mafia in order to feed the people in St. Petersburg after the economy collapsed.
The United States for many years, from the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, from the 90s through the 2000s up until right now, America has been acting as if we are the only game in town. If you need support or if you need organization or if you need you want the United States on your side as a trading partner, then you're going to have to bend to our will and you're going to have to do what we want. That has garnered us such disfavor in the world and made so many enemies because we've alienated so many people that it has left a vacuum for friendship, basically, for diplomacy.
Gus and Marshawn, what do you think of the comment I often hear from people is that America has to be strong, and Obama is showing strength, or he's not strong enough. But the emphasis is we've got to be strong. What do you both think of that?
America has to be strong for our interests, but that strong does not mean beating your wife when she doesn't do what you say. You know, you need to have some kind of give and take and relationships with people in order to get them to help you. They have to like you, and you can't just make people do what you want out of fear. That doesn't work.
Well, Marshawn, what do you think? Are we Are we pursuing a strong foreign policy? Is it not strong enough?
Well, part of the problem, and I agree completely with Gus, we have to have a foreign policy that's strong to protect our own interests, but at the same time, you can't use that strength to try to intimidate other nations to get mm-hmm. them to do what you want, because, like you say, they end up resenting you. I mean, Egypt is a great mm-hmm. example. We touted out, oh, we support democracy, we support democracy, we support democracy. Well, I lived for a while in Egypt, and it was a dictatorship. You said you didn't like the government. You went to jail. They yanked out your fingernails. They shot people. They had underground gulags. But no, we liked them. It was complete and utter hypocrisy.
Because they did what we said.
Exactly. Now, on the other hand, and real
strength, tolerate evil. You know, we'll tolerate unspeakable evil as long as would they do what we want in industry and in geopolitics. It's
exactly.
Ridiculous.
As long as they play ball with us. We like Saudi Arabia because they're anti-Russian, at least right now. We liked Mubarak because he was pro-American, anti-Russian, anti-Saddam. We liked him. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I think we're missing, and that certainly I think Putin's starting to pick up on, is there was a little-known imperialist movement in Britain in the 19th century. It was called the Albertson School of Thought. Now, Prince Albert, who was the husband of Queen Victoria, had this idea of an empire built not on exploitation, but on commerce. He dreamed one day of the Cape Town to Cairo Railroad, which he said would do the job of 100,000 soldiers because it would carry with it British goods and commerce up and down the entire African continent. And thus, you would have an empire that would dominate the continent without actually having to control or exploit the local populace, because you would be giving them something, and as a result, they'd be giving you something, and they'd want to be your friends. They'd want to be your allies. They'd want to be close because you were bringing them something. The railroad representing British culture, civilization, technology. The problem is then what you had developed was the Benjamin Disraeli school of thought, which was we go in and drop the hammer and make them live the way we want them to. And that's kind of the mentality that you've seen develop in the United States. If we really wanted to be a strong country, we would have a strong military so we could protect ourselves from the likes of China, Russia, and North Korea. But on the other hand, we would spread our influence through the likes of the Cape Town to Cairo Railroad, the 21st century equivalent.
You know, March, it's interesting when we contrast the two empires here, Russia and the United States Empire, in our mentalities of militarism, because in Russia, they have a united front of nationalism where they don't really care what your ethnicity is, what your preferred language is, where you come from, as long as Russia is your priority and the nation that you fight for. And contrast that with the United States, where we have such a fractured base. We're even having conversations like, is it racist to have an American flag up on Cinco de Mayo? You know, that is what we're talking
also,
about.
Also, Gus, we're a totally commercial people. I would like to note that Vice President Biden's son, Hunter, who's an attorney, has joined the board of Burisma Holdings, Ukraine's largest private gas producer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's about financial advantage.
It's about cronyism. Cronyism
at every level. It's not about nationalism. What we stand for in this radio show is that the national interest and the interest of the American people should come first,
right,
ahead of the interests of a handful of corporate elite who want to manipulate our public policy.
Yeah, because it was all about the oil under George W. Bush and Halliburton and the military contractors, and you think everything's going to change with this smooth-talking Obama, and what do you get? You get nothing but the same thing. It's lobbyists and people lining
their
pockets.
Exactly, Gus, and there's a phony left-right debate that's been going on in this country for years.
Mm-hmm.
There is, as Ralph Nader said, there's one beast with two heads.
Mm.
The real dispute that's going on in this country is between the corporate elite manipulating our policies to maximize their short-term profits and the true interests of the American people. Marshawn, could you talk about the reports of Russian bombers patrolling U.S. West Coast?
Absolutely. Earlier in the month of May, we were starting to get reports that Russian Tupolev bombers were flying off the coast, were circumventing Guam and flying up and down the west coast of the United States. It happened on multiple occasions recently. And it is something very, very frightening because the Russian bombers were able to get close to the United States before we scrambled jets. I mean, they were off the coast of California. The danger here is these are very large bombers. They were designed to be seen and send a message. Mm. Russia, though, also possesses hypersonic bombers that skim the Earth's atmosphere, and these we might not detect at all. They also possess stealth drones, which these drones could carry in them some kind of ordnance. They could carry EMP abilities. Lockheed Martin was actually testing a drone, and this is going back several years, but Lockheed Martin was testing a drone which could fly over buildings, drop basically a electrical cone, if you will, and everything it flew over went completely dead. Mm. Now, if Russia was able to get something like that, because we have this technology, so do the Russians, if they were able to fly these over the west coast of the United States, they could shut down whole segments of the electrical grid. I mean, without the electrical grid, cities on the west coast, especially closer into the desert, would die without water. This is a very, very dangerous thing that Russia is getting so close, and it's receiving no coverage in the U.S. press.
Yeah, you're talking about a shutdown of hydroelectric dams, overloading of major electrical relay grids, exploding transformers, and it would take months for those to be repaired once they've been overloaded. Because they are made custom for the power stations that they're built for. So it could take 5 to 6 months to have just any one of these power substations repaired and on the West Coast. So you are talking about tens of millions of people, if not up to 100 million people because of the way that the blackouts would roll and cascade. This would be a major catastrophe, especially since FEMA can't even handle a hurricane.
We are the sick man of Europe. For those World War One buffs out there, the sick man of Europe referred back in those days to the Ottoman Empire. But in reality, we've become, as a military power, decrepit. I mean, this administration especially completely neglected the national defense aspect. And the national defense covers all aspects of American society. Our poor infrastructure, mm-hmm. that weakens our national defense. Mm-hmm. Reducing the size of our Air Force, reducing the size of our armored units weakens our national defense. Having a smaller Navy, having weakened sonar nets is reducing our nation's ability to defend ourselves.
We treat readiness almost like it's an outdated idea, like we're never going to have war ever again. So from now on, buy all your food at the grocery store and nobody have a backyard farm.
And we can invade countries all over the world, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, mm-hmm. you name it. But no one's ever going to attack the United States. We don't need to worry about it. One of the reasons why we try to bring to the people's attention how much we are being threatened by the Russians is not to make them think, oh, let's go out and fight the Russians. Quite the contrary. We want people to rethink this foreign policy. Do we want to keep poking sticks at the Russian bear? What are our real interests? Aren't our interests really in defending this country, not in trying to seize foreign assets in order to get commercial advantages for a handful of Americans?
And I think it's important also to show how unprepared we are for the fight we're picking.
That's right.
Right? You know, to show that we are not capable of responding to such a fight.
So it seems like that's what we're saying. We should have a twin policy, Marshawn. And I'm going to editorialize a little bit. And I know, Marshawn, you really stick to the analytical matters, which is great. But it seems to me what this implies is we need to move two changes. We need to change our military policy so that it's not interventionist, and that its focus is on defending the continental United States, Alaska and Hawaii, but basically defending our territory. And the second is we need a new foreign policy, which cultivates, like Washington and Jefferson, friendly relations, good trade with all countries, instead of seeking to exploit our foreign countries.
We have to also work on building national unity. We really don't have a cohesive idea of what defines an American. Yeah, I'm an American, but you know what? I'll fly the Mexican flag, or I'll fly the Irish flag, or the Puerto Rican flag, or I'm, you know, there is no united sense of being an American. And the problem that exists when you have that kind of mentality is if we're invaded, it makes us very easy to divide, because there's a movement right now in the Southwest called the Movement for a Republic del Norte, which is a Mexican republic in the Southwest.
Yeah, Reconquista.
The Reconquista, exactly. Now, imagine if the Russians and the Chinese were to land, and they were on the West Coast, and they were to say, you know what, we will give you Republic del Norte.
Make a deal.
Now, you are, instead of fighting to defend your homeland, you're now fighting an insurgency as well as fighting an invading enemy. Right. Now they have a ready force of collaborators.
Excuse me, Marshawn, I just want to remind listeners that they're listening to the In Context War Report. on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. You can visit our website, incontextreport.com. We're broadcasting the fourth Monday of every month from noon to 1 p.m. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe. I'm your host. I'm here with Gus Cadavera, our producer. And on the phone joining us is Marchand McDermott-Rowe, In Context military affairs commentator.
And the thing is, I'm not anti-immigration. I am a descendant of immigrants myself. I love the melting pot. I love diversity. I love Mexican food. That's it. If you come here because you like what America stands for and you like the opportunity that it represents, be American. Where I live is America, and I want it to prosper because I live there. So I want everyone who comes here to respect it.
Marchand, I'd like to talk about some of our allies. That is in NATO. The U.S. recently was urging France to not deliver amphibious warships that it contracted to deliver to Russia. Why is our NATO ally France selling warships to Russia?
One of the problems that we're seeing in Europe, and there's the arrogance of course, the American press right now, which is saying, oh, the Europeans are spineless. They, you know, why aren't they supporting us against Russia? The problem is the only European economies that have any strength left in them is Great Britain, France, and Germany. And right now, those countries are trying to hold it together because when you look at most of the EU, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Ireland, Greece, their economies are completely hollowed out. They're total wrecks. So the French right now, they're teetering. They're trying to keep their country lumbering along. So when we say to France, oh, just don't sell those to Russia. We don't like Russia. Don't sell them. Well, France is thinking these ships are worth possibly billions. And that's billions in revenue that's going to be lost that we can't afford to lose. Are you going to buy the ships? Who are we going to sell them to? Because that's the thing is those are high market items. They can't sell them to Nigeria. They can't sell them to Cameroon. They can't sell them to South Africa. They have to sell them to a superpower because they're so expensive.
Right.
And if the U.S. isn't willing to fill that economic void, we really can't expect this French to just martyr themselves on the altar of the, you know, American foreign policy.
Yeah, and we burned our bridges when we wore everybody out with the Libya invasion. We're asking everybody to pay millions and millions of euros or dollars a day flying war jets over bombing stuff, and you end up with this al-Qaeda-controlled backwood you know, disaster where you have racial division and religious division and people getting beheaded, and it's a total travesty, you know. And everybody's like, why did we do this? Why did we throw in our lot with you?
You know, interesting. You brought up the Mideast, Gus, because the confrontation between the U.S. and NATO on one side and Russia and sometimes China on the other side is being played out not just in Ukraine but all over the world, and we're seeing it played out still in Syria. And a supposed insurrection, which is really fomented by the United States about 4 years ago. And it's really a surrogate war between the United States and Russia and Iran on the other side, supporting
and
the
Syria,
Assad,
perfect example,
government.
Because what country voted not to assist us in a blockade of Syria? The Great Britain, right? So France was integral in Libya. Great Britain decided we're not going to get suckered into this.
Into Syria because...
Into Syria.
Well, Syria used to be a French colony, so I think the French are thinking they're going to get back in here. And recent development in Syria, I would like you to comment on, Marchand, is that Homs was recaptured by the government from the rebels. It was a rebel stronghold. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I mean, this, to me, is just more evidence that the Syrian revolution, quote unquote, is done for. We're shipping in anti-tank missiles, according to the Debka file, which is an Israeli intelligence newsletter, very reliable source. They were reporting that the United States has been shipping to the Syrian rebels surface-to-air missile systems, MANPADs, man-portable surface-to-air missile systems, presumably only going to the moderate Syrian rebels. And
not the crazy ones.
Not the crazy ones, no. And anti-tank missiles to not the crazy ones, but the moderate ones, as if there's a delineating line anymore between these organizations, because we all know that the al-Nusra Front, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate, works hand in glove with the Free Syrian Army. They're all interconnected. But what the recapture Homs demonstrates is how dwindling the resistance is. And it's very important to note that the resistance to the Syrian government was not crushed by a sudden resurgence of the Syrian army. It was crushed by the arrival of Russian special forces. again, it's an open secret, but the articles were there. They were in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper. They were in Debkafal, the Israeli intelligence newsletter. Russian special forces and Russian SOBR counterterrorism units were boots on ground right as Assad was presumably about to fall. The American press was declaring Assad will fall any day. Then all of a sudden these units arrive and Assad's making a resurgency. So what you're seeing here is not just a victory for the Syrian army, but it's the overwhelming power of Russian special forces supported by the Iranian Quds force and by Hezbollah. What we're seeing in Syria is the United States is really all we can do is try to be a thorn in Russia's side there. That's really what the U.S.'s main effort is in Syria right now, is just to try to keep the Russians distracted so they don't pay attention to what's going on in Ukraine.
Now, the Russians let us take Libya. Why did they draw the line at Syria?
Libya was harder to resupply. That was the number one issue. Libya had on one side a United States ally, Egypt, and Egypt has no love of Gaddafi because Gaddafi's tried to invade Egypt a couple times, which ended badly. I mean, it was like one of those two-day war kind of things. But Gaddafi was not popular, and more importantly, the region was very difficult to supply. You had really pro-American governments on either side of it and an ocean to the north and a desert to the south. So there really was no practical way for Russia to support. On the other hand, Syria was the perfect place to draw the line because the Russians had a naval base there. It was the perfect place for Russia to make its stand because the first place Russia brought in its special forces was through the port of Tartus in Syria. And when we thought the government was crumbling, all of a sudden reports were coming in that Russian ships are arriving by the droves claiming they're there to evacuate Russian citizens. But people are seeing tanks unrolled off of these ships.
Well, they had to make room for the people.
Exactly.
And this is the only Russian port in the Mediterranean, right?
It was. The United States was a little late to the game, but we decided we were going to back President Mohamed Morsi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, because we suddenly realized that nobody liked Mubarak. What a shock. And that went really well. Oh, yeah. So we decided we're going to back Mohamed Morsi. And, of course, there's a military coup.
Right.
And General El-Sisi, who takes over, he then proclaims that Russia is basically going to be their new overlord, if you will. And the way he does this is that President Obama tries to call the presidential palace. El-Sisi refuses to answer. He instead makes a call to Moscow. Within several months, El-Sisi, it was actually earlier last month in May, made a trip to Moscow to meet with Vladimir Putin and to sign a deal to establish a Russian naval base in Alexandria. And this again was reported in Haaretz and reported in Debkafil, but not reported in the U.S. press. But this is huge.
Do you think that the military coup in Egypt was supported by Russia in back channels?
Absolutely. I have no doubt the FSB had their hands in there because the military in Egypt historically has been pro-Russian. Nasser tried the non-aligned movement thing, and then after it became clear that the United States was going to support Israel against Egypt, Nasser realized his only choice was to go Soviet because the U.S. was forcing him into a position where either you support the United States and Russia, too. Russia's not blameless on this front. Russia and the United States were pushing the non-aligned movement into a position where you have to align.
Yeah.
We've been giving billions
of dollars to Egypt as part of the Camp David Accord since Jimmy Carter back in the 70s. Why would the Egyptians decide to go with the Russians after receiving all this money from the United States?
Reliability. Russia is the traditional ally of the Egyptian military. But first of all, every Egyptian president since independence has come from the army. And the army historically was always pro-Russian. Well, Mubarak was different. He came from the Air Force. And most importantly, he was the national security apparatus. Again, one of the things I remember when I was in Egypt was the police ran everything. The army was pushed to the background by Mubarak because Mubarak couldn't trust the army. So he had his national police service run everything. So the army has no reason to feel affection for the United States because even though Egypt received billions from the United States, the power of the army was greatly diminished. On the other hand, under Russian tutelage, the army rules the roost, in Egypt. So that's really why the army would go pro-Russian.
The military has passed another law or something saying that the Muslim Brotherhood can never hold public office again. Are you aware of that?
And 1,000 members of the Muslim Brotherhood have been sentenced to death, most of them in absentia. What do you think about all that?
Well, this is all also following an old Egyptian tradition too. When the army ruled Egypt under Nasser and under Sadat, they had a policy of outlawing the Muslim Brotherhood. And in fact, under Nasser and Sadat, they executed hundreds of members of the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, I got to visit the old Egyptian prison located in the old Fatimid castle. And you see the execution wall, it's stained with blood. And that's where he executed all of the communists and socialists and the Muslim Brotherhood folks. And so this is kind of following in an army tradition in Egypt of going after the Muslim Brotherhood. Also because the Muslim Brotherhood, in the eyes of the army, has – before it was the symbol of international Islamism, which was a threat to the army's rule because the army was nationalist. They were more right-wing than they are left-wing, although they were identified as left-wing because they were pro-Soviet, much more right-wing, much more militantly nationalist. The Muslim Brotherhood was seen as internationalist, so that's why it was a threat. Now the Muslim Brotherhood is a threat because what we're seeing is the United States has become the force of jihadism and Islamism, and radical Islamism. I'm obviously differentiating between moderate Islamism and radical Wahhabism, Al-Qaeda-like, because what you're seeing in places like Syria is who is the United States backing? In Syria, the United States backed al-Nusra, an Al-Qaeda affiliate. In Libya, we backed the Islamic Fighting Group, another Al-Qaeda affiliate.
Right. Marshawn, I'd like you to pursue this some more, but I just want to remind our listeners that they are listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. We're on the fourth Monday of every month from noon to 1 p.m. Our website is incontextreport.com. You can contact us directly by email by writing to Ken at mdrtalk.org. That's Ken at mdrtalk.org. And what we try to do in the show is bring you up to date on many global military developments, geopolitical developments, and to interpret them in a way that makes some sense, in a way that you may not hear in the corporate media. We've been talking about the conflict between Russia and the United States and how it's playing out, not just in the Ukraine, but in places like Egypt and Syria. And Marshawn's talking also about how the United States in recent years, despite its avowed war on terrorism, has actually become very involved with some of the most militant Islamic groups. Marshawn, could you talk about what is Wahhabism and how does it connect to groups like the al-Nusra, which is operating in Syria, or Boko Haram in Nigeria?
Absolutely. When I talk about Islamism, there's an important distinction, because there are democratic Islamic movements, there are moderate Islamic movements. Islam is not represented by the extremists. The problem is the extremists have the guns, and the extremists, generally speaking, follow an ideology known as Wahhabism. Wahhabism is most symbolized by the regime in Saudi Arabia, that and the Taliban. They represent pure Wahhabism.
I would like to remind the listeners, if they would like more information, more in-depth on Wahhabism, we did a video that's on our YouTube channel that is lays out the history of Wahhabism.
Wahhabism is an ideology born out of the 18th century Saudi Arabia by a man named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, and his idea was returned to the quote-unquote fundamentals of Islam. Well, in reality, he was returning to the most medieval interpretation of Islam, which is ironic because in the Middle Ages, the Islamic world was very enlightened. But it's basically a Bedouin form of Islam. It's a un-Islamic form of Islam, but it is very repressive. And that's what makes it very appealing to any kind of dictator, is it's a very repressive system. It represses political dissent. You cannot listen to music. You cannot listen to news. You cannot have education, which is contrary to Islam, because Islam prizes education. The stories of the wives of the Prophet Muhammad is that they were all very well educated. They could all read and write. But Wahhabism denies women, and it denies also a lot of men too, the right to read and write, the right to a Western education. It's very convenient for any kind of authoritarian dictator, right,
I understand
in
that,
the Middle East.
In fact, that Boko Haram, which is this fundamentalist group in Nigeria, actually means Western education is sin.
Exactly. It means Western education is sin. Education is forbidden. The interesting thing about Boko Haram, again, what shocks me is Michelle Obama going, bring back our girls with her, you know, puppy dog face and everything on in that picture with the hashtag and whatnot. Yeah. And the fact is that why is she so interested about what's happening to these girls in Nigeria? but no concern about the girls being murdered, raped and murdered in Syria by our allies, by the al-Nusra Front, being raped and murdered in Libya by the Islamic Fighting Group, being raped and murdered by the people we're negotiating with, the Taliban in Afghanistan, about the millions being murdered in Tibet. No, 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 no. They don't count.
But could you talk about the Islamic Fighting Group in Libya and how it related to our overthrow of Gaddafi?
Absolutely. Gaddafi was, in many ways, he was out there. He was one of the more eccentric dictators, which made him very entertaining. But the one thing that Gaddafi wasn't was a Wahhabi. He resisted al-Qaeda. He believed in, it's very fascinating, his idea of a people's state, which would have Islamic principles, but it wasn't an Islamist state. It was very, he reached out to other African countries. Again, I'm not defending, he also was a dictator. I'm not defending his regime.
And an egomaniac, sure. Yeah, he had his flaws, but who doesn't?
But of course, the Chinese were big in Libya with the oil. And one of the things, the first things we did was throw all the Chinese out of Libya.
Exactly. But one thing he did do, is he was anti-Al-Qaeda, anti-extremist, and he was pan-Africanist. He really strived to help the developing countries in Africa. Again, he had his own agenda. He thought he was God's gift to the world, and he imprisoned political dissidents. But of all the dictators for us to go after, we can tolerate the Taliban in Afghanistan, but we can't tolerate this guy. We can tolerate a despot in Egypt, but we can't tolerate this guy. We funded and backed the number one opposition movement, violent opposition movement in Libya, which was the Islamic Fighting Group. Islamic Fighting Group has always been an al-Qaeda-linked group, openly al-Qaeda-linked, but they were anti-Qaddafi. So we armed them, we trained them. The ironic thing is that the Islamic Fighting Group, in addition to also arming and training and sharing funds with the al-Nusra Front, the Islamic Fighting Group funds and arms Boko Haram. So ironically, the United States, in arming and funding the Islamic Fighting Group, we're also de facto funding and arming Boko Haram.
You know, folks, when you're at the airport and they make you take off your shoes because some terrorist is about to kill you, or you're on the subway and you see the sign says, if you see something, say something. You should be remember that we are actually supporting, working with some of the supposed these terrorist groups that we're supposedly fighting, and ask yourself, is there something fundamentally wrong with our foreign policy?
Well, not just that. What is the target of these see something, say something ads? Because it's not al-Qaeda.
No, it's you and me. It's to keep up the scare, as Bedford Forrest used to say.
Well, and that's the interesting thing that you're starting to see in terms of the security state, is the focus has begun to turn away from al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is no longer a bad word. It's like cholesterol. You know, there's good al-Qaeda and bad al-Qaeda. You don't want too much of the bad al-Qaeda. You want a lot of the good al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. But the national security state is now turning itself inward on its own citizens.
Although we focus on the war news on this show, we have to also talk about sometimes the effects of our foreign policy and military policy.
The implications,
which is curtailment of our civil liberties and the degradation of our economy as resources, which should be used for investment in America to create good-paying jobs for Americans, are being diverted to war.
And overall cultural tension. The average American is so busy with their work and family lives that they just can't dig deep enough into the news to try to figure out what's actually happening. Define the strategy here that we're invading all these countries and using the people who we're supposedly chasing at the same time to do the work.
What the powers that be play off is just that. Nobody has the brain power at the end of the day to do anything, if they're even interested in the news, but to turn on CNN or Fox, watch it for 5 minutes, and then go to bed.
We're going to have to bring the show to a close pretty soon. But before we do, I did want to talk about the U.S. other major rival, which is China. It's also challenging the U.S. effort for global hegemony. And recently, the United States indicted 5 members of the Chinese military for hacking the computers of major U.S. corporations, including Westinghouse, in order to steal U.S. trade secrets. Gus, could you talk about this for a moment? What is this about, and how do you think it's going to affect U.S.-China relations?
What I find very interesting about it, because I've spent a little time in Asia, you know, I made a documentary about Cambodia, and so part of my research and interviewing people while I was there in the country twice last year was talking to people about the culture in South Asia and East Asia in general. And what these countries all have in common is that their culture is based on saving face. So if you accuse somebody of doing something outright, stealing or doing doing some kind of underhanded business deal, they are going to become highly offended and they're going to deny it. No one will ever say, that's right, I'm sorry. That will never happen. It will be emasculating to do that. So instead what they'll do is deny it and brush it under the rug and hope that it goes away. If you persist, they're going to retaliate because in order to save face, they need to deal with you and do the same thing to you 10 times worse, basically, to make you regret ever having confronted that person. So confrontation is really not a good thing to the harmony of the culture. So I'm highly interested in what the United States strategy is here to openly confront and accuse this Asian country that they know is going to react with denial.
Well, and of course, we acknowledge, Edward Snowden, the whistleblower, revealed that the National Security Agency of the United States spies on China Telecom. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the largest providers of cell phone and internet service in China. And the objective apparently is to obtain text messages, which are sent by Chinese military personnel. So we're doing it to them, but apparently our theory is that it's okay to spy on governments, mm-hmm. but it's illegal to spy on private corporations,
right.
which is convenient because a lot of the people we spy on, like Petrobras, the great Brazilian company, is state-owned. So that's okay because it's part of the government.
Right, right.
But we couldn't do it if it was a private corporation. I think the Chinese regard this as kind of capitalist hypocrisy.
Mm. The other thing that I find interesting and very pivotal at this moment is that Thailand just had a military coup as well, and they're under martial law right now. Well, as of yesterday they were. I don't know if they still are right now at this moment. That's a very pivotal region, and Vietnam is currently undergoing its difficulties with China as well. There's threatening some invasion on the Chinese side to try to deal with some uncertainty in the government there. And all that country, so you have Vietnam, Cambodia in between, which is also a complete basket case of a government where they have Hun Sen, who's a holdover communist from the Pol Pot's regime, and also when he defected and went to Vietnam to become a Chinese puppet, Vietnamese and Chinese surrogate puppet. So the three countries there, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand, are pretty pivotal to the access to South China. And they're also trading partners with us, where
and
we
of
have
course,
a lot of our
Vietnam
manufacturing
done. Vietnam has offshore oil resources in Marchand. What do you think of the fact that Russia and China just signed this huge...
But just to finish the thought, us poking China as well as Russia all at the same time is really just inciting this entire region into a ring of fire that we're trying to seem to set off like it's a powder keg or something so that they'll fall into infighting. I'm really not sure exactly how it's going to play out. But proceed. Yeah, go ahead.
China just signed a huge deal with Russia for energy resources.
Mm-hmm.
Marchand, what does that mean in terms of the United States and in terms of China's national security?
Well, what it means is that right now, the United States and China are pushing each other in Asia. We're pushing the Russians. And what you're starting to see is like we see before every major war. And I can't emphasize it up before every major war, going back to the dawn of time. I mean, if you want to look at the Napoleonic Wars, look at the First World War, Hundred Years' War, War of the Roses, all of this, what you see is spheres developing. And so right now, the Russians and the Chinese have been getting close since Putin came to power. They signed they've had a mutual defense treaty since the days of the Soviet Union, but they signed a new mutual defense treaty in the early 2000s. They've had extensive military and intelligence cooperation. And now with this new natural gas deal that the Chinese and the Russians have signed, it's really establishing that they are now inseparable allies. One could almost compare this to the Pact of Steel between Nazi Germany, Japan, and fascist Italy.
It's a formidable combination for the U.S. to oppose. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for this edition of the In Context War Report. You've been listening to it. It's been produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and the In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month at noon on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Streams at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. We also have a YouTube channel, and we have quite a few documentaries up there, including the one we mentioned on the Wahhabis and other interesting full-length discussions of the history, for example, of the wars in Afghanistan. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm your host. I've been joined by producer Gus Canavero and our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next time.
See ya.
See ya.